Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 9, 2020. We have three cases on for oral argument this morning. The first case, which is what we are here on today, is A20-0711, Smiths as trustee versus Park Nicolet et al. Counsel, please mute your microphone when you are not speaking. The marshal will show a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the amount of time that you have remaining. Each party, I'd ask you to identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. You'll have 15 minutes for your primary argument and an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Mr. Van Orde, I'm going to ask you to mute your microphone, please. Go ahead, counsel.
The court, counsel. My name is Patrick Ahrens, and I represent the plaintiff, appellant, and the Short family. Medical malpractice cases rise and fall with medical evidence from medical experts. Here, the unrebutted medical evidence establishes that Brian Short was at a foreseeable risk of harm to himself and to others due to Park Nicolet's care. The district court accepted that medical evidence to find sufficient evidence that the tragic deaths of the Short family were proximately caused by Park Nicolet's failure to offer reasonable care, meaning the Short family would be alive here today if Park Nicolet had merely offered reasonable medical care to Brian Short. Yet the district court disregarded that same evidence when it decided no foreseeability of harm as a matter of law and concluded that Park Nicolet owed no duty to Brian or his family.
What's the difference, counsel, between causation? Is causation, does that always, and if there's sufficient proof for causation, is it always proof of duty then? I mean, they are different analytical issues, are they not?
They're different analytical issues, but when you look at the case law, especially in the context of third party harm, the cases talk about whether the harm was too remote in time to the care. And here, given the that there is evidence of proximate cause, that is evidence and should be accepted as evidence that the harm was not too remote and that it was directly connected to the bad care that Mr. Short received.
So evidence of sufficient to go to the jury on proximate cause is always in a case of medical malpractice or failure to give reasonable care, it would always be evidence sufficient to prove a duty, to go to the jury on a duty? Well, can there never, ever not be a duty? I'm trying to distinguish between those issues.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here, on the facts of this case, when it comes to proximate cause and a causal connection between reasonable medical care and the harm that resulted, they're absolutely, that same evidence compels the same finding that there's a foreseeability of harm. And so the foreseeability of harm, which is what is driving the duty here to the family members. And so to answer your question, I'm not aware of all circumstances or a per se rule that causation will always mean that there's a foreseeability of harm or a duty, excuse me. But here there is an extreme overlap between whether the harm is causally connected, whether it's sufficiently connected in time to the foreseeability of harm that Park Nicolet knew about on the front end. And so certainly the medical expert testimony that was sufficient to find a causal connection must also be sufficient to find at least a disputed fact issue over the foreseeability of harm that Park Nicolet knew about or should have known about here. And I'm going to continue to touch on that in my remarks. I do want to focus on three primary fundamental errors that the district court made in its decision. And the first is that the district court eliminated Park Nicolet's duty of reasonable medical care. The district court and Park Nicolet on appeal argue that the only relevant duty in a case involving third-party harm is a duty to control or a duty to protect. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has rejected that argument. It rejected that argument in Becker versus Mayo. The plaintiff in Becker had presented two independent theories for recovery, one on a duty to protect or duty to control analysis, and a separate one for a duty of reasonable medical care in a medical malpractice context. The Minnesota Supreme Court denied a duty to protect or duty to control under the facts of that case, although it recognized it was a close one. But it made clear that the inquiry does not end there, because it had to go on and decide whether the standard of care, whether there was sufficient evidence for the standard of reasonable medical care to go to the jury. And the district court found those duties to be separate and distinct and reversed and remanded for a jury trial. Here, there's no dispute at all that the Short family has offered evidence about the standard of care, about what the standard of care for the treatment of Mr. Short was, about informed consent, about prescription medication with reasonable care. There's no dispute that we have sufficient evidence on the issue that Park Nicollet breached its standard of care. And so just as in Becker, this court needs to reverse and remand so that the Short family can present its case about reasonable medical care, at least as to Brian. And what I'd like to transition to now is the second error, which is just as Park Nicollet owed a duty of reasonable care to Brian, that duty extends to Brian's immediate family because of the foreseeability of harm.
Why is the duty limited only to his family? I mean, if there's a foreseeability, I mean, if your claim is that the departure from the standard of care in the treatment of Brian was caused or familicide or some other violent act is a reasonably foreseeable outcome, why does the duty end there? And how far does it go, counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. It does not end with the family. It includes the family. So I want to be very clear about that.
But then how far does it go? I mean, does it go? I mean, say there's some violent act that occurs in the community. Does it extend to every member of the community who's affected by the violent act?
Every case will have its own facts. What we know in Lundgren versus Fultz is that the Supreme Court was willing to extend that duty to all random members of the community. So I do think, to the extent you're dealing with an individual in a case involving mental health who is unwell and who is known to be at risk of a foreseeable harm to himself or to others, that the duty could, under the right circumstance, extend to the members of the community.
So what's the proposition of law that you are asking us to extend? You're just asking us for an examination of whether a reasonably foreseeable duty can extend to the immediate family with whom the patient resides or with whom the patient has contact, or what are the limits here?
Well, every case should be assessed for its own facts. And what we know here is that the medical experts have identified the family as being particularly at risk as far as third parties. In addition, when you look at Warren versus Dinter, when you look at Skillings and Malloy, you look at, are there third parties that were relying on the medical treatment? And what we know from the record evidence, from the Wilhelm Declaration, from the witnesses that testified at deposition and want to testify at trial, is that the Short family relied on Park Nicollet to help Brian get better. They didn't know what else to do. Brian went to Park Nicollet because he was sick and he was unwell. And the experts will also testify, as they have in their expert reports, that people that are closest to the individual in this sort of situation are most at risk, whether it's in the home or in the workplace. So I don't think this court needs to draw any broader limits, because the facts of this case, with the expert testimony in this case, with the particular witnesses in this case, make clear that the family was relying on Park Nicollet and they were at a particular risk of harm. And what I'd really like to focus on is Park Nicollet knew this. And again,
yes, counsel, what's your best case on this proposition? I mean, the cases that you I know that the Skilling, I think Malloy and Dinter, like the third party was involved in every case, in every one of those cases in some way. By talking to the doctor because their child was a patient, or by talking to the PA and Dinter Warren, who then talked to the doctor, et cetera. What's your best case for the proposition that someone who is harmed is a foreseeable plaintiff then for medical malpractice? Someone who is harmed by the patient is a foreseeable plaintiff in a malpractice case.
Thank you, Judge Smith. And I'd like to just go back to Warren and go back to Malloy, because I disagree on the facts of those cases. In Warren versus Dinter, the patient, the person that ultimately passed away, never spoke with the hospitalist who was alleged to have committed the malpractice. That was a conversation between a nurse and the hospitalist that led to the cause of action. So there's no direct communication between the decedent and the negligent hospitalist.
Yes, but in Dinter, wasn't the communication of the specific medical status of the decedent, so that there was it was communicated that there was a specific person that was being talked about, and they were actually given the labs of that person.
Judge Hooten, those are the facts of that case.
So it would be more foreseeable.
Well, first of all, this is a fact-specific issue. And again, there are facts in the record that the family actually did rely on Park Nicollet to treat Brian Short. That is undisputed. They had nowhere else to go.
Isn't that true of every case where someone, a family member, sees a doctor? The rest of the family assumes that the doctor, I guess I don't know, that seems to be true in every case where you have a family member who's seeing a doctor. Whereas I understand the facts of Warren v. Dinter. I understand, the person who died sought medical care. The family here didn't seek care. They are just a family member of someone who got care. So I'm trying to understand the limits of where, if any, maybe there are no limits. The reasonable foreseeability is that the case law too. And there's, when you look at case law, there are policy issues. It's a legal question about what is reasonably foreseeable. And that's what I'm trying to figure out is what role does the court have in determining that question?
The difference between other medical malpractice case involving a patient is that the harm may arise to the patient, him or herself. Here, when you're talking about mental health, this unique field, the failure to give Brian proper treatment created the risk to his family. And so the family members may not always know that a patient, even in their family, is seeking care. They may not be relying on that. What we know on the facts of this case is that the family did, and they didn't know what else to do because they were relying on Park Nicollet to help him, and they believed he was getting help when in fact he was getting incompetent care.
Does the black box warning also contribute to the foreseeability that, I would say the black box warning and the peer-reviewed studies regarding familicide, are those also sort of the linchpin of your reasonable foreseeability claim?
Absolutely. And again, the facts of this case show that it is a factually disputed issue over foreseeability of harm. You have the FDA black box warning, which is the trade-off that the government recognizes these drugs are so dangerous to some population of the people, but helpful to others, that they allow the manufacturers to make and sell them, provided that they make this most extreme disclosure to the doctors. And then it is up to the doctors, or in this case, a nurse who treats eating disorders, to give the proper direction and warnings to the patient, which she did not do in this case. In addition, Park Nicollet's own documents identify someone with Brian's exact condition, specifically passive suicidal thoughts, as someone as an acute safety concern to himself and to others. Third, on the altruistic murder aspect of familicide and suicide, this is an issue of medical literature. And Dr. Pope, among our other experts, are preeminent experts in the field. It is a concept that he's opined on. Peer-reviewed literature support it. Brian had all the hallmarks for it. And those experts deserve to be heard. As I see my time's running out in the affirmative time, I do want to touch briefly on the duty to control and the duty to protect, because that is a viable alternative theory as well. Lundgren versus Fultz, most directly, you know, the question is the doctor's conduct so closely connected that the law is going to allow a cause of action? Here in Judge Smith, this goes back to where we started. The fact that there's already been sufficient evidence for proximate cause answers that question affirmatively in this case, far less attenuated here than the 18-month period in Lundgren versus Fultz. The patient was an outpatient at that time. That's entirely consistent with Section 41 of the restatement. And there was an ability to control precisely because Brian was a willing patient and wanted to get better. And with that, I will rest on my affirmative argument.
All right, thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions from the panel? I know that Judge Hooten is still present. She just has turned off her video. Anything else?
And I have one question. I mean, as I understand your argument, the issue is whether there's a foreseeable risk of harm to the injured person. And I suppose anytime you have a depressed person that is treating for depression or anger issues or whatever, and may own a gun, that they might be dangerous and more dangerous than the person perhaps who doesn't have these mental health issues. Does that situation end up in there in the healthcare providers being responsible then to people who may be the subject of a mass shooting? Or, I mean, how far does this foreseeability go? And is there anything that would limit the foreseeability that may be available? In other words, is the whole world pretty much is it possible the whole world could be foreseeable that they may be injured by this potentially dangerous person? Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is not a situation where there's going to be strict liability of any sorts. What is critical to understand about our position is that all Park Nicollet had to do was reasonable care, offer reasonable medical care to Brian, which was accepted in the field. And in that respect, it's no different than any other medical malpractice case that where there are limits on causes of action, especially with expert affidavits to institute an action. And it's also critical to understand this. Brian was not just had the blues or he was down. He was his severity of his condition cannot be underscored enough on this record, especially without a trial. He had a screaming PHQ-9 score of 23. He had an immediate reaction to these drugs, which track exactly the black box warnings of what was foreseeable and what was reasonable to expect. And the fact that he was a firearm owner the peer-reviewed literature does say that increases his risk. So it's really the totality of factors here. Again, it's a fact-specific case. And while it may be like in Lundgren versus Fultz that there are random members of the public that the duty would extend to, that there would be foreseeability of harm, that's not for this court to decide here. The court only needs to decide here whether his family and those very close to him, which the experts have opined were most at risk, whether there's a disputed fact issue that should go to the jury over that question.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Aaron Van Oort, representing Park Nicollet. The district court in this case correctly held that the estates of the Shorts do not have a negligence claim against Park Nicollet for two reasons. The first reason is that Mr. Short's violence was not reasonably foreseeable. The second reason is that there isn't any special factor in this case that takes this outside of the general rule in Minnesota that one person is not liable for the harms caused by a third person. I'd like to start with the question of foreseeability.
Isn't there the law in Minnesota is that a person owes a duty to protect where that person's own conduct creates a foreseeable risk of harm to the injured person?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the Domogala case and the others. And the rule there is that where the actual risk of harm is created by the defendant, where it didn't exist before, then there is a duty there. But as the Supreme Court recognized in the Tomfer case, a case of treating mental illness does not fall within that because this is what the Supreme Court said in Tomfer. The mental condition of the patient exists prior to the hospital's allegedly negligent act. And that's certainly true here. You know, Mr. Short's mental condition arose from his business and all of that, and all of the screening things say that it predated him coming. The claim here is not that Park Nicollet created his mental condition in the first place. It's that they didn't do enough to treat it allegedly. That's the claim.
Is that accurate, though? I mean, isn't part of the complaint that the treatment that was given actually caused suicidal or the homicidal tendencies, that can actually be a result of the care? And in light of the Supreme Court guidance on, you know, that you're very familiar with and that has been briefed on many cases, when there is a fact question, even on the issue of a legal duty, that goes to the jury.
Yeah, the rule is that duty is ordinarily a rule for the court unless it's in close cases, meaning that there would be factual inferences that would actually change the legal outcome on that, Your Honor. And the courts have agreed to that misfeasance and nonfeasance can sometimes be difficult. But there's never been a case from the Minnesota Supreme Court that has exposed a medical provider to liability for a patient's violence, except on a duty to control or duty to warn. That's never happened, and that would be a really significant change in the law here and an expansion. And the counsel on the other side has arguments for why you should do that, but it's clear that it'd be a really significant policy choice because, for example, in the state, no state has done this at the Court of Appeals level. The decision to expand liability in the way the plaintiffs are doing has only and ever been made either by a legislature or a Supreme Court.
Well, let's imagine for a moment, counsel, let's imagine a different case where someone has a mental health problem, depression, sees a counselor, and that counselor gives, you know, for purposes of this argument, I know we're not talking about reasonableness of care because we're focused on duty and you, but the therapist gives terrible care and actually advises a person, you know, sometimes suicide provides a relief. That's a way out, you know, and introduces the idea of suicide, promotes the idea of suicide in violation of the standard of care. Why would that be such a departure from just general rules of legal duty if that person in fact commits suicide?
Oh yeah, that would be a clear case of misfeasance. And this is what the Supreme Court, and this is the Doe 169 case. They said, you know, when we say misfeasance, we mean active misconduct working positive injury to others. And what you're saying of a medical provider encouraging suicide absolutely would be active misconduct.
And is that so different from prescribing drugs that have a known possibility of increase of suicidal tendencies, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just let me get to the facts of this case. Although I want to say, Your Honor, all of these arguments about from counsel on the other side are about the standard of care and breach, which is not really what we're talking about. But just to be clear,
I know.
Their experts don't say that it was wrong to prescribe Zoloft. They just said, well, you should have prescribed more. They don't say it was wrong to switch to Lexapro. They just say you would have done more. And if you look at their expert reports, every single heading says failure, 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 failure. They aren't saying that anything they did was wrong. They said they should have done it more or they failed to do other things. And that's clear straight down the line. They aren't saying that it was wrong to have him treated here. They said they should have brought in more. It wasn't wrong to see him this many times. They should have done more. It wasn't wrong to combine drugs with cognitive therapy. They should have done more. This is a nonfeasance case within there. But really, like I said, Your Honors, everybody agrees in this case that there's no duty if there's not foreseeability. And so because that is legally simple in that sense, I want to start there, and especially with regard to the homicides, the killing of the family members. There is no way that this is foreseeable under existing law, because these are undisputed. Mr. Short never had any violent ideas against them, either while treatment or ever. He never made any threats. He had no history. There was absolutely nothing to suggest, either to Park Nicollet, which is what matters, but for that matter to anybody else, that he would ever act in this way. And when you compare these facts to the facts that the Minnesota courts have previously held violence to be unforeseeable, it's not even close, because we cited the Studeben versus Roman Nose case, where this teenager who was committed and had a history of violence, an assault with a baseball bat, they said it was not foreseeable that he would commit violence. You know, there's the Davidson case where, you know, the son had been delusional and threatened his father. That wasn't foreseeable, the courts held. And on and on, Silberstein, a man who had previously made threats against the same man he ended up killing, it wasn't foreseeable there.
Well, Mr. Van Hoort, could I ask you this? Because, I mean, we're dealing with an issue that I think we all agree that that foreseeability is a fact issue. And all of the things that you're raising here seems to be a dispute of facts as to whether it was foreseeable or not versus the plaintiff's facts here, which I think are primarily facts that were presented by the experts, as well as other medical records. I mean, in that there is an issue of fact here, shouldn't it be presented to the jury, as the Supreme Court has noted in other cases involving the issue of foreseeability?
Yeah, there aren't any disputed facts here that make this foreseeable, Your Honor. And I want to explain why. All of the cases I just cited are summary judgment cases. Summary judgment was granted. The Doe 169 is a recent case with sex abuse from the Supreme Court where summary judgment was granted on that. And so the simple fact that there's an expert doesn't mean there's a fact issue. The Whitehead case, another recent case from the Supreme Court, summary judgment was granted on foreseeability, even though there were experts in that case. What matters in the area of violence in this is, my sense from reading the cases, in the areas of violence, the facts have to create the sense, like, he might actually do it. This is not a products liability case where there's no intervening act, you know, and that's what counsel rely on, where there's no intervening intentional act. In that situation where you look at tens of thousands or millions of products going out, foreseeability asks, well, might this happen through negligence? That's never been how the courts have applied violence, because of concern, really, about holding one person liable for the intentional acts of another. And so in the violence, there's no recent case from the Minnesota Supreme Court finding violence. And this goes both for the violence of a murder and for the violence of a suicide. There's no recent
case. Have any of those cases, excuse me, counsel, have any of the cases that you've talked about that involve violence, though, involve the provision of medical services such that there would be the medical malpractice alternative, or, you know, basis rather for liability?
No, several of them did involve treatment in a facility. So the Roman knows he was receiving counseling and medication on that, and others. There isn't anything where a patient was being treated on an outpatient basis on that there, because, you know, historically, of course, the duty here has been limited to duty control, and it's only been applied when a patient was in custody, Your Honor. So there isn't anything precisely on these facts. It has never been recognized. And I want to transition then and, you know, just address the second point, which is that there requires usually both foreseeability and then some exception, because, again, this is from the Minnesota Supreme Court, and in Your Honor's courts has repeated this. Minnesota follows the historical common law rule that one person is not responsible for harms committed or caused by another, unless there's an exception. The typical exceptions have been control. Counsel on the other side, although he's arguing about control here, there's been no control ever imposed in a case like this. The closest is Lundgren, where the psychiatrist had control over the guns the patient ultimately used and gave him his guns back. And foreseeability, you know, it was clear because he'd been threatened there. There's no issue of control here. The other issue has been a duty to warn. But the counsel conceded that that's not an issue here either because the facts don't support it. You need a specific threat against a specific person. The argument here is not based on a duty to take Mr. Short into treatment inpatient, either voluntarily or involuntarily, because the Minnesota statutes make that immune. And they say good faith decisions on that, whether it's involuntary or voluntary, are immune under Minnesota Chapter 253B.23, subdivision 4, which we've cited. So that's immune. There is no case in Minnesota that has extended a duty to a medical provider holding them liable for the violent actions of theirs absent one of these things.
So is your argument, counsel, and maybe this is obvious, and I'm sorry if I'm asking an obvious question to you, but is your argument that because there's intentional harm by a third party, that the only duties that can arise are a duty to control or a duty to protect, and that a duty to provide reasonable care to the patient who committed the harm just simply is just that has to fall within control or protect. It doesn't provide any independent basis. Is that your argument?
Yeah, that it doesn't provide an independent basis for the liability for those intentional harms. That's correct, Your Honor. There is, of course, a duty of care to all patients who come in, but it is not the duty in the sense that the breach of that makes you liable for the violent actions there.
Irrespective, so you don't need to, if you looked at the reasonable care, the duty to provide reasonable care, then are you saying you just can never address whether it's reasonably foreseeable that that person would commit suicide or hurt someone else? You still have to put it within that control or protect framework.
Yeah, there's control or protect, Your Honor, and then there's the active malfeasance, like Your Honor said, advising them. Those are the two exceptions that Minnesota law has recognized. And as I said, some other states have recognized broader duties than that. Not this state. And so, for example, counsel states the restatement third, section 41. That section acknowledges it's changing the law. But then it says, okay, if we're going to broaden the law this broad, what we need to do is we need to have protection along with it. And so they built in good faith immunity on that. The Ohio case, the Supreme Court, where they made that similar extension and extended it, they created good faith immunity to go along with it, which would mirror the Minnesota statutes for admission. My point in this is that for everything counsel is arguing, there are countervailing things. For all the arguments, if we're going to go a duty to disclose information or bring the families in, there's a right of privacy on the other side. For every argument,
so I'm having a difficult counsel. I'm having a difficult time grasping why the duty to provide reasonable medical care that involves the control over the dosage or the dispensing of medication that contains a black box warning and it is attributable to the end acts that actually occurred here, why that isn't any, why there's any functional difference between recognizing that duty as an exception to the duty to control as opposed to other duties that are recognized as exceptions.
Your Honor, I think the reason that is that would fall into, you know, what the law is called, the cases are called nonfeasance, a failure rather than active misfeasance or malfeasance.
But prescribing something is more than passive inaction. Seeing somebody multiple times changing their medication, we're well beyond passive inaction here.
Oh, I agree that they were actively doing, but the argument by the plaintiffs is not that it was a problem to prescribe this medication. They're saying maybe you should have done more. They're complaining about all the things that weren't done, not the things that were actively done on here. But what basically, Your Honor, what this comes down to is a policy choice. The Minnesota law has not applied a duty here. The best case they have is the Becker case, But that was a duty to report, a mandatory duty based on the statute on there. That was not the analogous duty here would be a duty to warn, which everybody agrees there. And duties to report or warn are clear. You know when they arise and you can easily fulfill them. This idea of expanding everything out into any argument about standard of care, the dosage was a little high, the dosage was a little low, you saw him too often, you should have seen more, the family was too involved, they weren't enough, that opens up an entire new field of litigation on here, and it involves some really extraordinary policy choices. And Minnesota law recognizes that by granting immunity to a lot of these choices on admitting decisions on admitting or not, whether voluntary and other care. And so what I'm saying,
Counsel, yes, I see that your time has expired. If you just want to wrap up, Counsel.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. What I was going to say is if there is going to be a decision made to expand Minnesota law on that point, and to be clear, it would be an expansion because there's no case like this that exists. That decision would have to be a full policy decision made by the Supreme Court. It hasn't happened yet.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ahrens?
Yes, let me get started. Pre-existing condition, there is none. There was actually summary judgment granted on Park Nicollet's defense, so that's not an issue. And in addition, when you look at the records, there's at least a fact dispute that his severe depression arose because of the care that Park Nicollet provided. That's not the anxiousness or the tightness in his chest that he first went to Park Nicollet with. Number two, malfeasance. Judge Frisch, you're exactly right. This isn't inaction. Park Nicollet affirmatively accepted him as a patient. They accepted a fee to treat him. They prescribed medication to him. They assigned a nurse instead of a psychiatrist who he desperately needed to treat him. The fact that they did all this action far exceeds what the Minnesota Supreme Court found as malfeasance in Fenwick, which was the Blake School merely allowing a licensed driver to drive across state. The fact that they then failed to carry out their duty after they undertook it and created the risk and the harm that flowed from it makes them liable as malfeasance. Studeman, Silverstein, Davidson, Judge Smith, you're exactly right. None of those are medical malpractice cases. None of them dealt with experts. None of them dealt with a roster of preeminent experts from Harvard that opined to the specific facts of this case. Studeman had to do with a halfway house. It had nothing to do with mental health providers that are specialized in the treatment of this sort of dangerous disease. Silverstein dealt with a welfare board, a county welfare board. None of them were medical experts that had a professional obligation and ability to treat mental health. Part of the reason they avoided liability is because they relied on doctors saying 6 months ago that the patient was no longer a concern. That's fundamentally different than the facts of the case here.
Mr. Ahrens, are you asking for a change or expansion of the law?
Absolutely not. The common law, as the Minnesota Supreme Court said, in Becker versus Mayo, is not static. It's not rigid. You just have to apply traditional notions of tort law about foreseeability of harm, about reasonable medical care to the particular facts of this case. Section 41 of the restatement is not a change in the law. It merely confirms the foundational principles that Minnesota has applied for over 100 years in the Warren Trilogy. I also take issue with the argument that we're arguing breach and not duty here. We have identified very particularized instances of Brian's condition that make the harm so foreseeable. That implicates a breach of the standard of care. And the fact is, had Park Nicollet undertaken and performed the standard of care, they would have identified these symptoms that made it so foreseeable to the experts that he was at such a danger to himself. Just as Park Nicollet's document, Exhibit 22 in the record, calls him an acute safety, refers to someone in his condition as an acute safety risk to himself and to others. It's the same thing with the SSRIs and the black box warnings. And of course, the medical experts are applying Brian's particular facts to this particular case. That's not breach, that's foreseeability of harm. Every wrong has to have a remedy. The argument that, we accept that Park Nicollet had a duty to provide Brian reasonable care, but the fact that harm resulted just isn't harm that can be brought in this case makes no sense. What is the Short family
supposed to do? Isn't that what legal, why is legal duty even an issue then if like a violation of care and causation always answers it?
It seems,
there are policy issues at stake. Otherwise, it does seem to me that every time that the standard of care would be violated and a person, the violence, of course, sadly, tragically, we see can be extensive by someone, that's the end of the inquiry. Was there a violation of the standard of care? And that's it. It's always liability. There's always not liability. Well, yeah, if it's violated and there's causation, that's it. There's a duty to every person who was harmed.
No, we always come back to foreseeability of harm. What I'm saying is the Park-Nicollet, on one hand in their brief, and we heard today, admits that there is a duty of reasonable medical care. But there is no remedy to breaching that duty in the mental health context if you're not going to allow a recovery in this case where the harm flows directly from that breach of the duty that they admit they owed Brian. And I absolutely agree, Judge Smith, this is an important policy case, no doubt. Unless this court acts, there are gonna be more nurses that prescribe medication without even knowing the black box warnings. There are gonna be more drugs, not doctors, and there are gonna be more people harmed. And with that, I see my time is up, and unless there's any questions, I ask that your honors reverse and remand so this case can be heard on the merits from the witnesses at trial.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel?
No, thanks.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll issue an order within the statutory time period. We'll stand in recess until our next case. Thank you.
Thank you, your honor.